You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire, 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko Ruben McLaren toku ingoa, nō mai hare mai ki te wire mō tēnei rā. Kia ora, welcome to The Wire for Tuesday the 30th of January. I'm joined in the studio by producer Lisa Baudet, who was kind enough to help me out.
Hello.
How was your long weekend?
Good. Tiring. Very tiring.
What did you do? Did you go to Langway?
No, unfortunately I couldn't do that. But I listened to it on BFM all day long.
Yeah, I didn't do anything. I didn't even leave Auckland. So firstly, we have a chat to New Zealand Drug Foundation Executive Director Ross Bell about the cannabis bill being heard in Parliament today. On the Green Desk, Kelly fills in for Connor and speaks to a Waiheke organisation that are opposed to a new marina on Kennedy Point. Lisa Baudet speaks to Ania Kelly Costello, a Paralympian and a community organiser for Access Alliance, a group advocating for an Accessibility Act. And finally, our travelling producer Leonard visits the International Buskers Festival to learn more about the busking lifestyle. Remember, if you want to let us know your thoughts on any issues we cover in the show, please give us a call on 309 3879 or send us a text on 5395. I think the text costs about 20 cents or something.
Like, naked is the theme. Like, people just love getting naked.
This afternoon, MPs will vote on the government's plan seeking to make medicinal cannabis more available. The bill purportedly lays the foundation for a regulated medical cannabis industry and also gives a defence for the terminally ill to use and possess cannabis. The Greens have submitted a similar bill that is more far-reaching. Their bill will allow patients with a terminal illness or debilitating condition to grow their own cannabis subject to a doctor's permission. Medicinal cannabis campaigner Rebecca Rader has criticised the government's bill, claiming that it doesn't go far enough and will still criminalise suffering people. Earlier, I spoke to Ross Bell, Executive Director of New Zealand Drug Foundation, to discuss the benefits and drawbacks and started off by asking him what he made of it all.
We actually think the government bill is a really good one. Certainly it has some weaknesses, but fundamentally the things that are proposed in that bill, once they're fully in place, which is going to take a couple of years, will actually create quite a robust medical cannabis system, quite similar to the systems that we're seeing running in countries like the Netherlands and Canada. So I think fundamentally it's a good bill, but yes, there's some things that it needs to be improved.
So do you see it as kind of a precursor to bigger and better things?
Well, I think what the bill does is create a structure that gives us better, gives us the good things that we want. It's just that those good things are going to take time. So if you look at the system they have in Canada, you have a government agency, which is what the Labor bill will establish, which oversees how the domestic production of medical cannabis products, how doctors get educated about those and how those prescriptions work and what the products are, the different compounds within those products and advice to patients and doctors about how those different products will benefit different medical conditions. So, and fundamentally that's what the Labor bill does. It creates that structure where you would have an agency within probably the Ministry of Health that oversees the licensing of domestic manufacture, the quality control of the products, what's in them, and then advice to doctors about how to prescribe those. And ultimately, that's the thing that we want. Having a domestic system like that will give safety to doctors because they want that. It'll give clarity to patients and a wider range of products to patients because they need that. And the unknown part, but the one that we assume will happen, is it should reduce the price, the expense of these products. If you have a domestic market, arguably that's going to be cheaper than bringing stuff in from overseas.
Yeah, so in terms of domestic production, are you advocating for companies under license to produce it, or would you also support those that are terminally ill to grow it themselves?
We would support both, which is why we quite like the government bill and then also Chloe Swarbrick's bill. So again, if we look at Canada has both systems where you have the government licensing, that government regulation, but also allowing patients or their nominated representatives to grow their own. And there's nothing, you know, and we think that works well in Canada, so there's no reason why that wouldn't work well here. You could argue that the government bill in creating that regulatory body, you know, it could well be that regulatory body then turns around and says, well, this, we're going to license these growers to do this, but we're also going to allow patients and their supporters to grow their own. I'm not sure that's what quite the government has in mind, but you could allow that to happen under that regime. If you don't allow that to happen under the government regime, then you need the Green Bill, which allows that patient growing to exist as well.
And so under Labor's bill, it will still be technically illegal for those that are terminally ill to consume the cannabis. They just won't be criminalised. They'll have a legal defence for it. Why not just make it actually legal?
Well, I think it will. Once you've got that system in place, and again, you know, the government has said that they're going to take a couple of years to get there. But once that's in place, essentially, you will then have a legal medical cannabis market. The defence they have for terminal patients, we're describing as a stopgap measure. Until you have that perfect system in place, here is a defence for terminal patients. I think everyone knows that doesn't go far enough. That defence should extend to many, many more people, including people in pain. One way that, and we haven't quite written our submission yet, but one of the things we're looking at is whether we propose to government that they don't go down that here's a defence route. Instead, they be more proactive and create a system that they have in New South Wales, which is a kind of an amnesty list where a patient and the people that grow their medicine proactively get put on a list. And, you know, they say, well, you know, my doctor, which is approved by the doctor, get put on the list, and if you're on that list, the police leave you alone. So that could actually be a better way at managing, you know, that transition period than having this defence, because having the defence still implies that the police bust you and prosecute you through the courts, and then once you're before the court, you get to turn around and say, "Well, this is my defence." You want to stop. You don't want that to happen in the first place. So, I think having an amnesty list is probably a better way of dealing with that, and opening that list up to more than just terminal patients with terminal illnesses.
Yeah, it seems kind of funny, doesn't it? Because this is about health and pain relief. Surely arresting dying people can't be very good for their health.
Well, and the government, this government and previous governments argue that that's not happening, that these arrests aren't happening, which isn't true. We know that these arrests are happening, and it's not good for your health. It's hugely stressful at a time where, you know, you're unwell. Hugely damaging to your finances because, you know, lawyers are expensive, and that whole the criminal justice system is an expensive beast. So yeah, look, if this government argues that this issue is a health issue, which is what they have been saying, then we need to keep the criminal justice system well away from this. Ultimately, once the regime is in place, then that would happen. But until we have that system, we have to show the compassion and kindness that Helen Kelly was always talking about. And so we do, you know, we do need that. What we're wanting today, because this is the bill, the government bill's before the House today, we're wanting parties to vote, MPs to vote for this bill to select committee so that we can improve it, that we can support the bits that are strong and that we like, and that we can improve the current weaknesses in the bill. And fundamentally to show that kindness that I think many, many, many New Zealanders want shown towards people who use cannabis for medical purposes.
So on this proposed regulated cannabis industry. If the price doesn't really, in effect, go down, will the government be subsidising the products like other medicines?
Yeah, well, I think the government needs to do everything to remove the many barriers that are currently in place. One of the barriers is access to products, and so having a domestic market would deal with that. The other significant barrier is the barrier of cost. If having a homegrown industry doesn't reduce that cost, then the government will have to look at ways of subsidising it. And the obvious route, of course, is PharmAc. And if PharmAc doesn't feel that it wants to do that, then the government should do what the previous government did and give PharmAc additional money to subsidise these things. The government should be focused on getting rid of all of the barriers that are currently in place.
And under this current bill, should it just be the terminally ill that get access to medicinal cannabis? And if not, why so?
Well, it fundamentally it won't be. The medical cannabis will be available to all patients who need it. But again, that regime's going to take a while to get there. So once it's in place, then anyone who would benefit from medical cannabis arguably will be able to have that prescribed by a doctor. So that's the fundamental aim of the government bill, which is why we like it. The issue around terminal illnesses is just that narrow defence, which is essentially kind of that stopgap measure. And that's the bit that the government does need to broaden out to include people who are in pain and a wider range of illnesses, frankly. Anyone who benefits from medical cannabis should be able to have that as a defence. Or they could follow potentially our proposal, which is to have this amnesty list. So I think there is some confusion around this terminal illness thing. This is only a short-term sticking point. Once the full regime is in place, then we will have a proper medical cannabis regime in the country.
Do you see this as the beginning of a wider drug law reform in general?
I think it's part of the mix, but we've always been clear that these are two separate issues. We support a legal market for medical cannabis. We also support a legal market and a regulated market for adult recreational use. But I think the two things need to be separated because there is this fear. It's not a justifiable fear, but it is a fear, and it's one that, you know, has to be acknowledged, that if you do stuff around medical, somehow you're going to open the door to other things. I think we need to have two separate regimes, a regulated market for medical cannabis and a regulated market for adult recreational use. And why we want to treat medical differently is because there are legitimate medical cannabis, you know, there are legitimate medical benefits, but you know, patients need to understand how medical cannabis medicine will interact with other medications, what the different ratios that would work for different illnesses, how that is prescribed, et cetera, the quality control. You want to have some real rigor and robustness around the medical system, not just for adults, but for very young children who will benefit from medical cannabis. So you do, a lot of people just say, well, let patients grow their own, but ultimately you need to have much more rigor in a medical cannabis regime. So that's why that regime is going to be quite different to any regulations that ultimately happen for recreational use.
Is there anything else you'd like to add, Ross?
Well, the balance of power within Wellington right now, within the parliament, is a very fine balance. And if listeners want these bills to become law, then we need people to lobby directly. So what I would encourage people to do is ring up their local MP and say, you know, get them to vote for both the government bill and for Chloe's members' bill. You know, so if people are het up about this issue, who are really concerned about this, then the best thing they can do is actually to ring up their MP and get them to vote.
The Wire. Sitting on the beach watching transnational criminal scum neoliberal filth.
That was the New Zealand Drug Foundation's Ross Bell. We just had a couple texts in. One person saying great interview. Thanks very much for that, mate. And another person, Why do we even tolerate a government that takes such control over our private freedoms? If I smoke dope, it is my business alone and my responsibility. Cheers, Peter. More freedom, less government. All right, we'll be right back after a quick break.
Service at the King's Arms.
An ode to praise dressings by the last minute barbecue salad. 10 minutes till we go. My leaves are bland and dry. None will scoop me on their plates. I'll be left outside to die. But here comes my salvation, a flavoursome new blessing, a source of salivation, a quick drizzle of praise dressing. Now everyone piles me on their plates, I can't help but smile. If you're also wanting praise, it's in the dressings aisle. New praise dressings, mayos and aiolis, now in your supermarket.
Cheer up, what are you even worried about? Do you believe in climate change or something? Everything's fine, women can vote now. Hashtag feminism.
Concerned for the state of the world today? Want to shine a torch into the darkest crannies of current affairs? Every other week on The Wire is Worry Week, taking a topic of concern and digging in deep.
Next week, the Treaty of Waitangi.
Worry Week on The Wire, weekdays 12 to 1 every other week, with your rotating roster of hosts.
The Wire.
I don't know, and frankly the whole thing gives me the heebie-jeebies.
The Wire.
Kia tau te rangi marie, o rangi nui e tui honei, o papu tuanuku e takatonei, o te tai ao e awhinei I a tātou, tihei Māori ora.
This is The Green Desk with Connor Mercer on 95 BFM.
Yes indeed, it is The Green Desk, though today not with Connor Mercer. Instead we have Kelly. Kelly talked to Catherine Ngapo, who is the co-chair of the Waiheke-based organisation Save Kennedy Point. SKP is hosting a fundraiser and community event in the hopes of raising not only money but awareness for a marina that the Auckland Council has approved. SKP argues that the marina will be detrimental to the history and culture of the beautiful bay, and it is also alleged to have extremely negative effects on the marine ecosystem of the area, in which Catherine explains further.
SKP was formed to take an appeal to the Environment Court against the Kennedy Point Marina, and we are sort of a group of locals who believe that the marina decision is wrong and that Auckland City shouldn't have consented it. So for one thing, the marina is really large. It's 7.38 hectares, I think. And it has around about 200 boats in it. So we believe that that is a real intrusion upon that bay. And the bay has a huge amount of cultural and historical significance for Māori people. Also quite historical for Pākehā. So for Māori people, it's the place where the Te Arawa Waka came in not long after it arrived, after voyaging across the Pacific. And it was relashed at Rangihaua, which is, Kennedy Point is actually part of Putiki Bay. Putiki Bay is sort of a large sort of estuarine area. And so the Te Arawa Waka was relashed there, and then it went off and it did some more journeying, but one of the people on the Te Arawa Waka, Kahu Matamoimoi, came and lived at the pā Te Putiki o Kahu Matamoimoi. And so right from the 14th century it had a very historic occupation. It has 71 known archaeological sites around the bay, and included in that there are several pā sites. And what a local historian, Paul Monin, says is that the pā sites are really representative of a defensive, of tiers of pā. So there's a whole lot of defensive pā sites, and then there's the main site, Te Putiki o Kahu Matamoimoi. And that what you can see in this bay is that that's still there, largely physically in the form that it would have been years ago. So it's been not been sort of bulldozed into submission or totally gone. A lot of those sites are still there, but maybe overgrown with bush. Unlike in Auckland, so if you imagine downtown Auckland, that's that's impossible to imagine a Māori occupancy, but it's not the case here, and that he thinks that should be valued, and so do we. The other thing is that it was a huge... I grew up here, and my family ate from that, from the whole of Putiki Bay every day of my life until I was maybe six or seven, and then maybe 3 days of my life we ate from that bay. So it's it was a major seafood gathering area for Māori, and there's huge middens around the outside which show that. So that's one of the reasons we believe that if you stick a great big urban marina there, that negates all of that history and that cultural value. And
So what reason, you know, this deep-pocketed developer obviously is doing this for some, you know, some purpose? Is it an economic
reason? You make a lot of money. If you're a developer, the way our law works, nobody owns the seabed. And so if you're a developer, you can come in and you can try and nab sections of it for free. So he gets that 7.3 hectares for free. So then he can put on marina berths, and it's going to be around about 200. Maybe they haven't finalised their numbers. The berth sizes are between 12 and 25 metres, so they're really big boats for more wealthy people. And the cheapest one is 135,000. So that's around about 130,000. I mean, we haven't been told that in absolute amounts either. So when you think about that, you know, you can make millions and millions and millions of dollars from doing a development like this.
And if we see a development like this occur, do you think around New Zealand it's likely that there would be other sort of sea...
Yeah, I do think that. I mean, that's how marinas are commonly... That's what happens in all marinas anyway. That's always for free, that seabed area. But in this particular case, there is a floating car. There is no land for them to build upon. So they have a floating car park with two large buildings, which is a precedent for New Zealand. And the precedent, you know, for those of us who value the coastal marine area and access to your coast, it means, you know, if they're allowed to do this, then all sorts of development could be sited on the water near the coast because there's a precedent. And the other precedent is that they're burying their grey water and black water tanks in the seabed, which we haven't heard of before. So that's worrying. I guess that the other main reason that we worry about it as well is that there are a couple of other things. The first thing is that marinas are really polluting. So the four marinas in the Auckland Harbour are said to put as much copper, toxic copper, into the environment as the whole stormwater catchment of the whole of the Auckland area, which goes into the Waitemata. Mm. So they're really, really polluting. And we worry that having a high level of pollution in our pretty clean bay means that we will lose the option of fishing and knowing that our food is safe to eat, and getting oysters and cockles and knowing that they're safe to eat.
Mm.
And also it means we have five areas of significant ecological areas which are on Auckland Council overlays within the large bay. And that means that, you know, they're ecologically important, and we're choosing to put a marina in an area where we have these five ecologically important areas. And what the marina is positioned near the head of the bay, near the mouth of the bay, sorry. And what that means is that when the water comes in on an incoming tide, it will come through the marina and take whatever is in the marina to the rest of the main bay and pollute it. And right now we have godwits there, we have dotterels there, we have variable oyster catchers, there have been reef herons.
And you've also got all sorts blue of penguins rare birds as well there,
yeah,
don't you?
And the main sort of wildlife that will be particularly impacted is the blue penguin, because their floating pontoon with their 72 cars on it and their two large buildings is directly opposite a council breakwater, and in that council breakwater there is a penguin colony.
Yeah.
At the narrowest point, that's only 3 metres away from the pontoon and the cars, and we believe that the penguins will be, you know, it will be a lot harder for them to come and go from their rock breakwater.
Mm.
There is a huge floating attenuator in the water, which is another big problem. It's, I think, 6 or 7 metres wide by about 400 metres long. And so the penguins, which would normally just swim through and up to the breakwater where they nest, they're going to be trapped out into the main channel by these attenuators. So that means instead of having quite a lot of space to move around in, they're pushed out to where all of the boats are coming and going, and penguins are largely killed by boat strike. So you'll have 200 more boats in the marina going in and out. You've got two, you know, the SeaLink ferries coming and going in the same patch of water, as well as 200 boats which normally occupy the rest of the Putiki Bay. So for the penguin, you know, I think that's quite a dangerous thing. They've got pollution and stuff from the marina. They've got harder access to get into the colony. They've got a far greater likelihood of boat strike.
That was The Green Desk with Connor Mercer on 95 BFM. Tihe Modi Ora.
More than a million New Zealanders are affected by some sort of disability, and for those Kiwis, leading a normal life can be a struggle. Work, transports or technology can become major obstacles to overcome, which is why Access Alliance, a gathering of 12 disabled people's organisations, is calling on party leaders to support the creation of an Accessibility Act via an open letter which will be handed to Disability Minister Carmel Cipollone on February 1st. I asked Anya Kelly-Costello, a New Zealand Paralympian and member of the Access Alliance, to tell me a bit more about the Accessibility Act.
The Access Matters campaign is a group of 12 disability organisations coming together along with New Zealanders from all walks of life, urging our government to introduce a strong legal foundation for accessibility in the form of an Accessibility Act, because we currently don't have one in New Zealand. We would really like to see accessibility become a priority, so the legislation is about setting a timeline to make sure accessibility, you know, stays in an important position on the sort of priority lists of business owners and educators and employers and, you know, architects and everyone. And it's also about making sure it is easy to enforce. And one way of doing that would be to create an independent sort of monitoring body as well, so that it doesn't just always come back to individuals to advocate for themselves, but that there's actually an enforcement mechanism there.
I don't know if our listeners who don't have disabilities realize what kind of struggle disabled people face on a daily basis, and I was wondering if you could give me maybe a few examples of those obstacles that you experience in your daily life.
What happens a lot of the time is that as disabled people, we're so keen to get on with our regular lives. We really want to kind of just be treated as people, that sometimes it's not actually obvious from the outside, just the emotional weight of actually having to kind of face and, you know, get around barriers so regularly. So, for example, the most obvious one is probably the physical accessibility side of things. So, you know, if you're in a wheelchair and a building doesn't have a lift and only has stairs, there's a physical access barrier there. There's also barriers for people with all sorts of other disabilities as well. So, for example, people with autism can often have kind of sensory overload if they are in an event or a place that's really crowded, really noisy, lots and lots of stuff going on, and it's pretty much impossible to escape unless you actually want to leave the whole place. Whereas just having a room off to the side, which is a quiet space, could really help to alleviate that. And so, you know, there is a lot that you don't see as well. In my case, I'm blind, and let's pick an example of website accessibility, for example. So sometimes the screen reading technology, so the synthesized speech that I use, websites are not designed to be accessible with that. And so when I need to be able to find something to click on the website, instead of telling me, you know, maybe what an image is of with alt text or what a button does, it might just say button to me. So yeah, lots of different examples, lots of different disabilities, but you know, we can all have a disability at some point in our lives, so this is relevant to everyone.
And there's also, like you said, a lot of things that people don't necessarily think about that turn out to be quite important in a disabled person's life, like what you mentioned about technology. Obviously we don't really think about this, but that could be quite tricky for people. So yeah, I guess there's a wide range of things that can be done to make people's lives better.
Yeah, and Andy, I think as well, I mean, it's been great for me as a disabled person getting more awareness of barriers that other people with other disabilities face, because, for example, I wasn't aware until a few years ago that flashy lights, strobe lights, can be a real trigger for people with epilepsy, for example, and that so often, you know, if you're in production or something like that, watching a show and you're not aware like what could be happening, that, you know, organisers of those sorts of events need to be conscious of that, or that, for example, people who are deaf, if you're in a building and a fire alarm goes off and there is no flashing like version of the fire alarm or like a visual representation of that, that could be a, you know, a real hazard if there are no people around to tell the deaf person that the fire alarm's going off. So yeah, a whole bunch of stuff.
You mentioned also in the open letter that it gets even harder for older people. How come? I mean, how so? Can you develop on that?
The thing is that a lot of people actually, they develop disabilities later in life. So they may not consider themselves to have a disability when they're younger. But, you know, as you get older, the chance that you will have a disability increases dramatically. If memory serves, the last New Zealand Disability Survey said that 3 in 5, 59% of people 65 years and older have a disability. So like, that's more than half of us. And the average age in the Blind Foundation of members is 82 years old. In order to make things easier in terms of transitioning into having a disability for older people, what would be really great is to be able to raise awareness among service providers and business owners, employers to a certain extent as well, as we're working, you know, older and older, of how important access to jobs and to health services and to all these different aspects really is.
The Accessibility Act also is advocating for minimum enforceable standards. What would those standards be? Is it really just sort of like, it's not just guidelines, I guess, but yeah, standards, minimum things that
employers or not just employers, I guess, a lot of institutions would have to align with?
The enforceability thing is really important because at the moment, the way our legislation works, we don't actually have enforceable standards in most areas. Is it like some provisions under the building code and stuff? But what we would really like to see is consultations where businesses and people with disabilities and government and everyone comes together to say, okay, so accessibility is too important to be optional, you know, like we need to really think about what we can all do together and enforce together to make sure that individuals, that people with disabilities are not sort of advocating to remove barriers one at a time, that we don't have to, you know, take every complaint we have as one individual that's really a systemic issue and sort of try and advocate on it as an individual just to get something that ideally would be systemic change. For example, we would really, I know in the blindness community, but it would be useful for a lot of other groups as well, would love to see audio announcements on all buses across the country. And at the moment, the way that we need to go about doing that is basically involves legal advocacy with different local level transport organisations, which is, you know, ideally we'd be having, I reckon, a national conversation about these things.
So you don't have to go for every town to see the local transport provider and advocate for this, but it would be done nationally.
Yeah, and the onus is not on you as an individual as well, because the reason that, basically, I think one of the main things with our employment legislation that's a problem at the moment is that if, let's say, just for an example, we continue with that reasonable accommodation example and an employer decides that it's too difficult to provide things or everything you need in, you know, an electronic sort of text-based, like a Word file format for you, if you complain that they've discriminated against you, you as the individual actually have to prove that discrimination took place rather than the employer proving that they couldn't have avoided it. The onus really does fall on, you know, us as people with disabilities. Yeah. And so, yeah, we'd really like to change that. And in line, that would be in line with Australia, for example. They have it the other way around over there. And other countries have disability-specific legislation as well. You know, the US, UK, Australia, Canada's working on it. And so we're falling behind in that regard too.
I was just wanting to finish on asking you if there had been, according to you, any positive change in recent years.
Yes, a few things have been really great. To get a little bit of context, New Zealand has signed up to a UN convention, which is on the rights of persons with disabilities. That's the reporting procedures in terms of our progress in implementing that have been fairly robust in terms of working across government and across civil society branches that are basically representing disabled people, so disabled people's organisations. And also we have a New Zealand disability strategy and action plans as well. And so they're basically about sort of a roadmap, if you like, for government agencies to see how they might best help people with disabilities. And the aspect that I would emphasise there is that now we are seeing a lot more collaboration between government and disabled people's organisations in writing, especially the latest action plan and the latest strategy to an extent as well. That collaborative aspect, you know, co-creating the action plan with representatives of disabled people's organisations and government around the table, that's really positive, and we'd like to see that environment, you know, continue with creating the legislation as well.
Just one final word about the open letter for our listeners if they want to sign up.
Yes, at the moment we are about to meet with the Minister for Disability Issues, Kamal Sipiloni, on Thursday. One of the things that we're going to do in that meeting is present her with an open letter that calls for accessibility legislation and this strong legal foundation that we've been talking about. So it would be great if you can take 30 seconds to sign that. If you go to Access Alliance, so accessalliance.org.nz, and if you click on Take Action, you'll find it there.
Can anyone explain why the modern day Wales are so big?
The Wire.
That was producer Lisa speaking to Access Alliance member Aini Kelly Costello. You're listening to The Wire. The time is 43 minutes past 12. Remember, if you've got any thoughts, send us a text on 5395 or give us a call on 309 3875. Thank you.
Why should New Zealanders care so much about this?
Because your children will curse you if you don't.
The Wire.
That song just before was Ernie by Fat Freddy's Drop. Over the long weekend, the Auckland International Buskers Festival took place. Producer Leonard Powell caught up with a few of the acts to get an insight into the life of a busker.
My name's Tobin Rennick, and the two of us have been busking for 12 years.
My name's David Graham.
Awesome, Tobin and David. So tell us a little bit about your performance that you just did.
We do a partner acrobatic comedy fire juggling show, and we're down here right on the Auckland waterfront. It's our first time ever performing in Auckland. The festival started yesterday, and we're going to be out here doing street shows through Monday.
And how long are you guys in New Zealand for?
Total, we're in New Zealand for about 3 weeks.
And you're traveling around a few different places?
Yeah, we started out at the Christchurch Busking Festival, and now we're up here at the Auckland Busking Festival, and we have little travel time on either side.
Right, and Tobin, how many places do you go to in a year, you two?
I honestly have never counted, but I would say roughly 20 maybe different locations. Some will just be for a day or two, some will be for a few weeks.
Yeah.
That's totally a random guess.
Right, and how much training did it take for you guys to get your show to where it is today?
Oh, I mean, it's years and years of training. The best way for me to compare it to something is to compare it to being a musician. It's the type of thing where, especially when you're starting out, you just have to do multiple hours every day, you know, 6 or 7 days a week to really dial in on some of the skills, and then the muscle memory kind of takes over. Yeah. So, yeah.
And just quickly with the busking lifestyle, like, do you have a permanent address you live at during, like, when you're not on the road, or are you guys always on the road, or how does that sort of work? I'm interested.
Yeah, we do have a permanent address. We spend the bulk of our time, I live just outside of Boston in Massachusetts. We're there generally from mid-April all the way through December, and we just travel from there to different gigs. And then we spend our winters 2 to 3 months in Key West, Florida.
Well, one of the most interesting places we've been with our show was we went to Pakistan, and that was a very interesting experience. Here's not necessarily a funny story, but it's a close call. It's one of the only wipeouts we've ever had in our show. It was in our last show in Pakistan. We were in a theater, and Tobin is standing up on my head, starting to juggle the machetes, and he comes down, and his feet get tangled up in my arms, and he comes right down into like a power push-up from, you know, 12 feet into the air, right onto his face. And there we are in Pakistan, and I'm thinking, you know, if he's broken something or something's major, this is going to be, you know, some hospital in Pakistan. Luckily, he was okay, and we made it back to the back home, and there were no major issues. But that was one of the scariest moments of our career.
Busking is a hard and extremely rewarding craft.
Yeah, and how did you get into busking, Pablo?
I just stood on the street with three juggling balls. With a big, crazy Dr. Zeus hat in front of me, and then I just got better.
And how long have you been doing it for?
16 years.
Still going strong?
Still going strong.
Awesome. And what's something in your 16 years, maybe either in New Zealand or around the world, that you've learnt about human beings from being a busker?
That people still crave good, live, spontaneous entertainment.
And what's your advice to busking crowds out there for the future?
Busking crowds?
Yeah, if you're like people who are watching you do your thing, what's one thing, if you could tell them one thing, people that you see them do that you don't like or people could do better, what would it be?
Pay your busker. Don't walk away. We're making an honest living.
I've been busking for 23 years, and I got into it by, I was brought on stage by another performer when I was 9 years old, and it was the most fun thing I'd ever done in my life. So the next logical step in that, of course, is to make your own show, which I did at 10, and that's when I started performing.
And you've been doing it since you were 10?
It's been the only job I've ever had.
Wow. What have your jobs of busking consisted of over the years?
Aside from the show, there's a lot of small jobs that go in there. The show that people see from a busker is only maybe half of what we do. It's like, we're also like, you know, basically sound engineers, audio editors, video editors, marketers, agents. I think that's what you were asking, right? Yeah. Kind of, yeah. So it's like really, the thing about being a busker is you're very self-sufficient. So you learn to do all of these little things on your own. And so that's kind of like the average day will be a few hours of administration, marketing, and then you actually practice your show, and then, you know, if it's a day where you do a show, you just go out there and crank them out, so.
And how's the industry changed with the advent of things like Facebook and that?
I think that actually social media is, it doesn't hurt, but a lot of the people who come to see busker festivals generally, and I don't say that, not all the time, but generally don't come to see one particular act. They come to see a whole bunch of different acts. So, yeah, I mean, it's pretty cool. You have people filming your shows and they send you pictures and, you know, it's pretty fun.
It's cool, yeah. And I think a lot of festivals use Facebook marketing as a pretty great way to reach their demographic. It's better than, although, but the ones are, the, like, cornerstone ones are still there, like radio and print, and like
television.
we were in the Herald, or like the Busker Festival was in the Herald and the Weekender, and that I think will reach more people probably, but yeah. It definitely has its own place.
And I'm interested, what's some things that, like, obviously you've been to a lot of countries, I'm guessing.
Yeah.
How many countries have you been to, and also what are some, like, things that you've learned over the years of busking about different cultures and human beings in general?
I've actually lost count of the amount of countries we've been to be honest. I'd have to go back and really think about
it. We're pretty lucky. We've been, I mean, over 30 for sure.
Yeah, at least.
And we've done our show in 5 different languages. It's really a cool trip. Like, it's interesting to study comedy through a culture and see what different groups of people find funny, and sometimes you find it by accident, and sometimes you do research and you figure it out. But like, obviously with English, it's easier for us to learn to do our show in the Commonwealth kind of countries. But even when we learn in another language, it's still people, and there's so many common threads that no matter where you go, there's a little more similarities than differences.
Yeah, the more places you go, the more you realize that everyone's pretty much ultimately the same. You know, like, it's...
There's still, obviously, there'll be cultural differences, but, yeah, people are the same.
Yeah.
And what's the busking community like? You guys tight-knit? Do you get along with the other buskers and stay with each other or travel together and things like that?
We don't usually travel together per se, but it is very tight-knit. Once you get to a certain, like, the people who do it professionally, there's not many of us, so it's...
You know most of them all over the world, and yeah, we're always at similar festivals with one or another, and yeah, we're a pretty close group, I would say, because not too many people do what we do, so there's not that many people who understand exactly what it's like.
Yeah, that's what she said.
Sweet. And lastly, thank you so much. If there's one thing advice you could give to people who are in the audience that would help you guys out, like, is there one thing that frustrates you as a busker that you wish people would do more of?
Just relax. Like, just, you know, it's, busking is a really beautiful thing in that, you know, there's a pretext that, yes, there will be payments at the end, but just, like, don't hold yourself back in any way. Like, no, a good busker is not going to shame you if you can't pay.
Yeah.
A good busker is going to leave you feeling good at the end of the show, no matter what.
All of us are here to travel around and bring people together in a weird way and and make everyone's day a little better. So, yeah, I feel like some people are a little standoffish. They really don't trust you at first, and it's, I mean, that's part of it. We know that's part of it, but yeah, just relax and get into the spirit.
Yeah, exactly.
It's going to be a good time.
So yes,
The Wire.
I don't know, and frankly, the whole thing gives me the heebie-jeebies.
The Wire. That was The Wire.
Yes, indeed, that brings us to the end of another Tuesday Wire. Just previously, that was producer Leonard Powell talking to the lovely folks at the International Busking Festival. Thanks so much for tuning in, and thank you to everyone who spoke to us, Ross Bell, Catherine Ngapo, Aini Kelly Costello. Remember, if you missed anything on the show or want to listen again, you can catch all the interviews at 95bfm.com/bcast. The time is 1:01. I'm Ruben McLaren. Jenna's up next with 1:04.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.